Okay, so I'd never met Matt and Ewan before until today, but thanks to the invisible hand of conference paper writing, what I'm going to say follows on very well from the previous two papers, and in some ways just kind of extends from what they've been saying. So my approach is a kind of history of ideas approach, and what I'm going to give you is a sort of, in some ways, a kind of slice of abstract intellectual history, but and in some ways it's quite basic what I'm going to talk about. But I think in some ways it does help to kind of clarify this question that's already come up in the discussion about what exactly is kind of distinctive or new about neoliberalism. And it goes back to one of the points that Mark was talking about in the earlier session, about the way in which neoliberalism is a kind of fundamental attack on the idea of there being a kind of inequality of bargaining power in the employment relationship. And that's really what I want to explore, is the kind of history of the neoliberal intellectual attack on inequality of bargaining power. But where better to start such an intellectual history than with Adam Smith and The Wealth of Nations? So in The Wealth of Nations in 1776, Adam Smith famously observed that workers were more vulnerable than the owners of capital when it came to bargaining over wages. And here's a long quote from Adam Smith. Smith said, "We have no acts of Parliament against combining to lower the price of work, but many against combining to raise it. In all such disputes, the masters can hold out much longer. A landlord, a farmer, a master manufacturer, a merchant, though they did not employ a single workman, could generally live a year or two upon the stocks which they have already acquired. Many workmen could not subsist a week, few could subsist a month, and scarce any a year without employment. In the long run, the workman may be as necessary to his master as his master is to him, but the necessity is not so immediate. We rarely hear, it has been said, of the combination of masters, though frequently of those of workmen. But whoever imagines upon this account that masters rarely combine is as ignorant of the world as of the subject. Masters are always and everywhere in a sort of tacit but constant and uniform combination not to raise the wages of labour above their actual rate." Many years later, in 1890, Alfred Marshall, in his seminal book Principles of Economics, which was the kind of foundation stone of the modern field of economics, echoed Smith by enumerating several respects in which he thought the sale of labour usually differed from the sale of other goods in a market economy. These included factors such as a pervasive inequality in access to marketable skills because of factors beyond the worker's control, the fact that it was necessary for a worker to be present in the workplace to sell their labour, thus creating preferences about the nature of the workplace environment and setting limits to labour mobility, and the length of time needed for workers to acquire skills and training, even though unforeseen changes in the market might very quickly render those same skills outdated. So fundamentally, Marshall agreed with Smith that the sellers of labour often faced what Marshall called special disadvantages because of the closely connected group of facts that labour power is perishable, that the sellers of it are commonly poor and have no reserve fund, and that they cannot easily withhold it from the market. As a result, said Marshall, it was certain that manual labourers as a class are at a disadvantage in bargaining. So all of these kind of views led Marshall and the other founding figures of economics to take a nuanced view towards trade unions. So, for example, most classical economists believed that trade union activity was necessary to prevent short-run wages being depressed by employer power below the equilibrium level. They thought unions were also necessary to raise wages during periods of high profits and to balance the dominant social and economic power of employers. Now, to be sure, the sympathetic stance was often balanced by anxieties about unions becoming too powerful or encouraging acts of violence or social disruption. But the tradition of market economics that had coalesced by the middle of the 20th century was nonetheless one that broadly accepted the need for workers' combinations to counterbalance the asymmetries of power and wealth that were produced by market forces. So one of the distinctive features of neoliberal economic thought as it emerged from the middle of the 20th century was that it denied that the sale of labour constituted a special sort of transaction, and accordingly espoused a much more uncompromising view of the ethics and economics of trade unionism and of labour market regulation more generally. This break from the market economics of an earlier era was sometimes consciously articulated by neoliberal theorists. For example, the somewhat obscure character, a South African-British economist called W.H. Hutt, who wrote one of the kind of earliest works on collective bargaining from this neoliberal school, a 1930 book called The Theory of Collective Bargaining. In that book, he explicitly set out to critique the view of the labour market and workers' combinations that had been articulated by older liberal authors such as Adam Smith, John Stuart Mill, and Marshall. And Hutt argued that these earlier analyses rested on what he called vague phrases about the disadvantages of uncombined labour, and also vague phrases about the indeterminateness of the price of labour, which a more rigorous and consistent application of market principles could dispel. But in other works of neoliberal theory, this historical departure from liberal market tradition was downplayed or left undiscussed, and assertion criticism of trade unions was presented as entirely in keeping with an enduring liberal lineage that could be traced back to Adam Smith, and that's the more common rhetorical tack that you get in texts like Hayek or Friedman. Nonetheless, I think the novelty of this analysis of the nature of labour represents one of the most important respects in which we can speak of a neoliberal ideology taking shape during the 1950s and 60s and emerging as an influential political discourse in the 70s and 80s. Neoliberals denied that unions equalised the bargaining power of labour and capital, since they believed that the owners of capital were in principle as vulnerable to competition as workers. Employees, they argued, in fact enjoyed considerable choice and mobility with respect to employment opportunities, while employers found themselves confronted by powerful labour interests willing to use coercive force to achieve their goals. So the key political implication of the neoliberal denial that labour was a special sort of commodity was that legislative intervention to equalise the bargaining power of employers and employees in fact privileged trade unions, creating mighty state-sanctioned interest groups that hampered the operation of the market. Unions were re-described as monopolies that sought to control the price of labour in order to charge a price of it in excess of its competitive level. And this characterisation of union activity sought to debunk the perception, fed by the kind of popular historiography of the labour movement, that unions had emerged organically from the struggles of ordinary workers to protect themselves from the exploitative power of big business. So in effect, they were trying to disenchant that kind of vague sense of labour history that had a kind of dominant hold over a lot of the kind of discourse about industrial relations in many Western countries at that time. And what the rest of the paper does is just kind of run through the various dimensions of this attempt to disenchant labour history. So I'll just mention a few of them. Now, the first one I want to talk about is just the kind of fundamental economic criticism of trade unions that neoliberals made, because it's sometimes forgotten exactly what it is that economically neoliberals don't like about trade unions. Now, the essential point that neoliberal economists tried to drive home in their analysis of collective bargaining was that far from protecting workers' interests, unions increased unemployment and income inequality. So they had quite a kind of strong counterintuitive argument. Now, in some ways, this was a kind of empirical claim, but the argument, the way they made it, tended to be couched in more abstract terms as a logical outcome of the application of basic economic principles. So since unions raised the wages of those already in a job, it followed that employers would control their costs by employing fewer workers and would be reluctant to take on additional workers. So this would raise unemployment. This is the neoliberal argument. And this would in turn increase the pool of labour available for lower paid non-union jobs, driving down wages in these sectors of the economy. So on this account, unions were primarily devices whereby privileged groups of workers advantaged themselves relative to other groups of workers. So Hayek put it this way, he said, "The interest of those who will get employment at the higher wage will therefore always be opposed to the interest of those who in consequence will find employment only in the less highly paid jobs or who will not be employed at all." Now, the empirical evidence to support this argument was much less well explored in neoliberal writings compared to that kind of fundamental statement of economic theory. I think it would be fair to say there weren't actually that many kind of empirical studies to back up these claims, but it didn't prevent figures like Hayek from venturing quite strong empirical conclusions. So, for example, in the 70s, at one point, Hayek wrote that the British trade unions have become, quote, "the chief cause of unemployment and of the falling standard of living of the working class. Unions," he added, "are the main reason for the decline of the British economy in general." And Hayek predicted that the average worker's income would rise fastest in a country where relative wages are flexible and where the exploitation of workers by monopolistic trade union organisations are effectively outlawed. But as I've said, there weren't really any attempts to kind of run empirical studies to see if this was actually true or not. And in fact, the empirical economic studies that have been undertaken have painted a more nuanced picture of the impact of trade unions on labour markets and income inequality. So, for example, there's quite a robust cross-national statistical finding that unions narrow pay dispersion within workplaces and industries and reduce income differentials between middle-class and working-class jobs, all of which empirically dominate the disequalising effect of unions that are stressed by neoliberals, namely that unions raise the wages of certain groups of workers relative to others. So it's not that the neoliberal causal mechanism is in itself wrong, but just that there are other things going on in the labour market as well. And likewise, what is often known in the trade as the collective voice function of unions, their role in providing employee input into workplace conditions and organisation, that can also have a positive impact on economic efficiency, for example, by reducing staff turnover. But these things are kind of ignored within the neoliberal literature. But while we can have this kind of economic debate about exactly what's kind of right or wrong about that, I mean, I think the point to pay attention to, though, is that this kind of neoliberal argument about unions causing unemployment and inequality had quite important political implications that were very consequential, because politicians sympathetic to neoliberalism were able to kind of appropriate this connection, purported connection between unemployment and unionisation, in an effort to reassign responsibility for employment levels from the state to the labour movement itself. So if it is primarily labour market rigidities, such as high union density, that prevent employers from taking on more employees, then promoting higher levels of employment will naturally require efforts to break down such barriers to the efficient buying and selling of labour. And then much less attention would need to be devoted to the promotion of employment through traditional Keynesian remedies aimed at supporting aggregate demand. So in some ways, this offered neoliberal politicians an important argument for a more aggressive stance towards trade unions in the post-war period. So there is that kind of important economic aspect to the neoliberal critique, but it wasn't just about economics. There was also a kind of political dimension to the neoliberal critique, which was kind of haunted by fears about the threat that unions posed to the authority and legitimacy of the state. So neoliberals believed that the growth of powerful labour interest groups would corrupt government policy and ultimately weaken state sovereignty. Now, in principle, neoliberals were enthusiastic about the importance of spontaneous voluntary associations as distinct from coercive state activity. So they don't like coercive state activity, but they do like spontaneous voluntary associations as a key feature of a liberal society. But that then means they've got some explaining to do about why they don't like trade unions, because you would think on the face of it, trade unions look like an example of a kind of spontaneous voluntary association. So the way they get around this is by making a distinction between what they see as voluntary and coercive forms of association, and trade unionism was firmly assigned to the latter category. So while they stressed that it wasn't that trade union organisation was in itself impermissible, they were very critical of the specific form that it had taken in the 20th century. So the problem with modern trade unions, they argued, was that it forced individuals into taking collective action that they didn't personally consent to. And they used tactics like strikes, boycotts and closed shops that were coercive and sometimes violent. And they were artificially sustained in these activities by labour legislation enacted by the social democratic state. So they saw unions as presenting a challenge to the liberal state that was quite distinct from that presented by other forms of organisation. And as a result, their focus on the problems caused by trade unionism could appear, I would argue, disproportionate and neglectful of the similar kinds of issues that might arise in relation to, for example, business corporations or local government, both of which neoliberals strongly endorsed, and neither of which I think are obviously non-coercive or lacking in special legislative protection. Nonetheless, neoliberals pressed the argument that it was unions in particular that threatened the fundamental ability of the state to act as a neutral arbiter in economic affairs, standing apart from sectarian interests in the economy and enforcing general rules of competition for all to abide by. That's the kind of political critique that they mounted of trade unionism. there's a couple of kind of further, more in a way, more radical strands of argument that emerge from the kind of neoliberal thinkers that I think are also worth paying attention to. So the first is, some neoliberal thinkers actually took the radical step of attempting to abolish altogether the distinction between labour and capital. So economists such as Theodore Schultz and Gary Becker argued that the skills and knowledge acquired by workers should be conceptualised as a form of capital investment aimed at increasing the future income flow to an individual from their labour, and analogous to the spending on machinery and equipment undertaken by owners of more traditional forms of capital. So this is human capital theory. And Schultz and Becker were trying to demonstrate that this growth of human capital had been underestimated by economists and accounted for a considerable portion of 20th century economic growth. Now, in part, this idea is a kind of fruitful economic theory that opened up a range of interesting research questions for economists of various partisan stripes. And in some ways, you could say there's a way in which you could kind of turn those arguments in a social democratic direction, because you could argue that substantial public investment in education and healthcare would enhance economic dynamism and efficiency. But the language of human capital could be and was deployed in a fashion that was much more congenial to specifically neoliberal imperatives. It could become a kind of comprehensive description of the drivers of human behaviour, so that human capital pictured the individual, as Foucault put it, as an entrepreneur of himself. And on this account, individuals are chiefly focused on a competitive struggle for economic advantage, constantly seeking to increase the value of their assets, and thus enhance their future flow of income. So other domains of life are relentlessly subordinated to this overriding purpose and eventually colonised by the language of capital and competition. So in a way, the most radical implication of human capital theory is that the category of labour and associated ideas of class are actually displaced from social analysis altogether by the expansion of the concept of capital to include the very economic interests that were purported to stand in opposition to it. And then the final sort of neoliberal theme I want to talk about, really radical implication of neoliberalism, is the way in which neoliberals deploy the language of the consumer and producer. So in a way, the kind of key neoliberal argument is that consumer interests rather than producer interests are the way in which to realise individual freedom and economic efficiency. So the public interest is construed as being synonymous with the aggregated interests of consumers, whereas producer groups are regarded as seeking to advantage themselves at consumers' expense. So in drawing on public choice theory, neoliberals argued that the intensity of the interest felt by producer groups in their own affairs would, without safeguards, lead them to dominate policymaking on their trade, since consumers' interests were usually much more fleeting and less well organised. Now, of course, producer interests, if you think about that term, encompasses both corporate and labour interests. And a lot of work within the broad field of public choice theory is focused on both. So, for example, Manker Olson concluded that, in his famous work on collective action and the rise and decline of nations, that large companies and trade unions are actually equally damaging to economic growth. That's what Olson argued. But the kind of, you know, the key focus of neoliberalism as it evolved in the 60s and 70s was that the attack on producer interests became effectively an attack on organised labour. They became kind of convinced that business was embattled in the face of the new social democratic state and its allies in the labour movement. So you're kind of left with this picture, a kind of liberal society envisaged by neoliberals, in which individuals are free to exercise their agency as consumers, choosing between the variety of goods and lifestyles offered by a market economy. But as producers, a strict managerial hierarchy was to prevail. The choice that individuals exercised as workers was whether to accept an offer of employment or to leave an existing job in search of a new one. Neoliberals anticipated no further formal role for the exercise of free choice in the day-to-day running of businesses, which were to be the subject of authoritative decisions of managers. Now, this vision of choice within the labour market ultimately underestimated the structural barriers within a capitalist economy to finding and keeping jobs, and the extent to which hierarchical control of the firm constituted a constraint on liberty. But it is undoubtedly a vision that's proved very attractive to politicians, business interests, and ultimately many voters during the 1980s and 1990s, as neoliberals took on powerful trade unions in the name of breaking the producer interests that purportedly held back economic progress. And I'll stop there. Thanks.
Fantastic. Thank you.